2024, theory out.
Theory gone.
Evidence out.
Evidence
in? Out. No, in results.
Cinesomatics and results, baby.
Unmeasurable, unmeasurable results in.
I'm Gil. Here with me today, we've got the boy, Owen.
What up?
We're doing something a little bit out of the ordinary today. For a variety of reasons, neither Lillian nor Will could make it, so we thought we'd call in some reinforcements and do a sort of special episode. We've got a few things lined up for us to talk about. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. So for today, we are very excited to be joined by a special guest, Michael Peterson. Hey, Michael. Thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, everyone.
Folks who came to our live event in Toronto back in October will recognize Michael as our illustrious MC. I guess normally this is where I do like a substantive introduction, laying out some of your work and why it makes sense to have you on to talk about the topic of the day. But that doesn't really make sense given the grab bag of silly stuff that we're going to cover. So I don't know, could you maybe, you know, say a little bit about what you're working on these days?
Sure. I think my most important qualification for being here is that I went to grad school with both Owen and Gil. So it's a real pleasure 100%. To be here just to, you know, yeah, bring the gang back together. Absolutely. These days, I'm teaching at a university down in Missouri. I'm working on things like environmental philosophy, specializations in things like Derrida and Gramsci. And I have a book coming out, I guess, in 2024 about nuclear waste and Jacques Derrida. So, you know, find that on whatever academic shelf is nearest to you.
Awesome. Well, yeah, thanks so much for joining us. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I guess it's around New Year's. Did you guys do any like resolutions or anything like that? We talked about this last time.
Yeah, mine was to be more tired, to just, like, embrace tiredness, accept it.
Lean in.
Yeah, lean in.
I was going to try to do a pescatarian January and then realize how much travel I had to do this January. And I was going back home to Alberta, where the beef is more good.
It's criminal to go to Alberta and be a pescatarian.
And not eat. Yeah, so instead I'm making gumbo today.
It's the
and
I'll maybe put the
So I'll put the resolution off to February or something like that.
It's actually sort of fun to have you on for like a kind of special episode around this time of year, because the last two holiday specials were like almost made specifically for you.
That's right. That's true. First one was Derrida on the gift, and the second one was Gramsci on New Year's. Yeah. So it makes sense that the third one I'm actually here for,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah. We've been building up to this.
That's right.
All right. So let's get into it. So first up on the docket is the following burning question. Utilitarianism, bad moral philosophy or worst moral philosophy? So I guess let's start out with a quick temp check. How do you guys feel about utilitarianism in general?
I'm not going to go worst. I think bad is fair.
Yeah, I'm with Owen on this. I think bad, not worst, although maybe versions of utilitarianism can compete for worst. But in general, I think it almost redeems itself heuristically in that it's one of the best places to start if you're ever teaching ethics.
Well, yeah.
For just for functional reasons, it redeems itself a little bit there.
Yeah. That's true. Just on the value of making teaching easier, it deserves a little more credit. The worst is obviously like Beitrage and later Heidegger. Like Beitrage
That's
and
not
after Heidegger. That is far and away the
moral philosophy.
Yeah. All right. It's just too core the worst.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I will give it that it at least is what seems like an ethical theory. I've never understood why virtue ethics even counts. I don't know what anyone's talking about there.
Just look for people who are really good at the thing you want to be good at, and they'll tell you why they're the best for that.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah.
Virtue ethics is the best for kind of self-help, though, you know? Everybody needs a little everybody needs a little self-help guidance. Aristotle will help you out.
Yeah.
Yeah, and be mid is a great ethical principle.
Mid. Exactly. Well, we've talked a little bit about utilitarianism in our episode on effective altruism, which shares some of the basic conceptual terrain. But it's basically like ethics math, right? We use our good, reasonable powers of reason to rationalize our way into knowing what's best to do by considering the outcomes of actions. We weigh up the good outcomes against the bad ones. And this gives us an objective, neutral, and very rational way to figure out what the right thing to do is, since the right thing to do just means that which produces better outcomes. It's a really good non-circular definitions for sure.
You've been mad about the ethics math lately, eh? I've seen you posting about it. Yeah. What is it about the math, like the math part of it that pisses you off the most? I mean, I get it, but I'm curious, like what?
Well, it just doesn't work. Like there's no standard, right? This is like one of the classic problems with utilitarianism is like, what's our basic unit? Because we do have to do math at the end of the day. Like if you read Bentham, like if you read like the Introduction to the Principles of Morals and Legislation, he's like, here's the step-by-step guide. You add up the number of pleasures and add up the number of pains. And I'm like, I don't know how to qualify this or quantify it, right? There's no unit. So at that point,
it's a util.
It's a util.
What's wrong with utils?
Yeah.
It's no more arbitrary than minutes or seconds or pounds or
Fahrenheit,
degrees
Celsius.
Yeah. Exactly. So if you want to take on ethics math, I think you have to take on all measurable math.
Mm. Maybe I do. Maybe I do want to take on all measurements. No more measuring things. That's my resolution.
Well, no bad infinity
there
measurement.
There we go.
What bad infinity measurement? That's the problem, is that it's all aggregate, like what Hegel calls a heap of effects, you know? And you can't, that is the most like basic brain possible way of looking at effects.
Yeah. Well, sometimes it gets cashed out in terms of pleasure and pain, right? We want to produce the most pleasure and diminish pain as much as possible. And sometimes it gets cashed out in terms of the satisfaction of desires, right? We want to satisfy as many as possible.
For me, I just like to look at, let's go back to the virtue ethics thing. Let's look at some of the models, the real practitioners and the people that have spent their lives laying out the theoretical foundations of utilitarianism. How are they doing?
We're gonna check in on him in just a minute. We're gonna get there in just a second.
Okay, cool.
This is because you're right. That's the place to go. But I guess to give it its flowers, the basic utilitarianism laid out by Bentham in the 1700s was at least kind of radical for its egalitarianism. It argued in the context of a stratified aristocracy that the desires, pleasures, and pains of the filthy masses were just as important for ethics math as those of the upper crust. And on the basis of that kind of secular approach to thinking about moral problems, Bentham himself adopted some rather forward-thinking positions for the time. He advocated for universal suffrage, the abolition of slavery and capital punishment, decriminalizing homosexuality. He even had some ideas about extending rights to animals, which might not count as a positive for Owen. I'm not sure. That might not work for you.
Yeah, don't get me started on Bentham.
Don't get me started. Today, though, and to your question, Owen, the most prominent utilitarian moral philosopher is one Peter Singer, who... Yeah, I'm just going to call him. He's a real piece of shit, right? This is a bad person.
But he did get very old.
Hmm.
So if we're just judging consequences, and elderliness is good.
I mean, there's no way I'm going to live that long. So he must be doing something right.
There we go. That's consequentialism.
Mm-hmm. A lot to prop up the kind of charitable industrial complex too, which is important.
Yeah, that's really good work. He's probably most infamous for being pretty open about his support for eugenics. In his 1985 book, I can't believe this. Should the baby live? He openly advocates killing babies with disabilities on the basis that they have, quote, diminished prospects of enjoying an adequate quality of life. Quality of life, of course, being a term that never really gets defined all too clearly. What is it that counts as a disability severe enough for Singer to think that parents should kill their own children? Again, no clear definitions are given, but some of the specific conditions he names in his books include things like hemophilia, spina bifida, and Down syndrome. The man is a monster, right? This is horrendous evil shit. And don't think that these are like antiquated ideas that I'm cherry picking from 4 decades ago. I've got here an article published by the National Council of Disability in 2015 that was responding to some comments Singer made on a radio program. Quote, in the interview, which was perhaps ironically conducted as part of a press tour Singer is currently on promoting his new book about charities, The Most Good You Can Do, How Effective Altruism is Changing Ideas About Living Ethically, the professor advocated the shocking claim that healthcare laws like the Affordable Care Act should be more overt about rationing, and that we should acknowledge the necessity of, quote, intentionally ending the lives of severely disabled infants. Singer, who is known for his provocative and often contradictory views on animal liberation and infanticide, also repeatedly referred to disabled infants as it during the interview. Without offering any scientific evidence to support what amounts to a return to eugenics, Singer routinely contends, quote, the right to life is related to a being's capacity for intelligence and having preferences, which in turn is directly related to an undefined capacity to feel and or comprehend ethereal concepts like pain and pleasure. Without offering any concrete measure on how quality of life could or should be determined, Singer admitted, quote, I don't want my health insurance premiums to be higher so that infants who can experience zero quality of life can have more expensive treatments, end quote. Initial thoughts on this? I don't know. Should we just abolish moral philosophy, right?
Yeah, it kind of makes me think, whenever I think about Singer's kind of version of utilitarianism, I think of, you know, also not the best dude in the world, but a really great anti-utilitarian argument from Derek Parfit. Namely his so-called repugnant
conclusion.
I don't know. Yeah, so this argument goes something like, if the goal is just to maximize lives worth living or happiness or pleasure and whatever utilitarian calculus you want to use, then the real way to kind of hack this, the way to make this, to maximize the gains, so to speak here, would be to find out what that minimal quality of life is and make sure as many people as possible are living right on the positive side of that minimum, and then making sure as many people as possible exist who are on that level.
Right.
So we'd want to have the maximum amount of barely worthwhile lives being lived as possible, because on aggregate, that's the maximum amount of good or pleasure or whatever. And Parfit, of course, is, you know, he calls this the repugnant conclusion. He thinks this is a good argument against utilitarianism. But I think Singer might sort of be into this. I suspect he might bite the bullet of the repugnant conclusion.
I always kind of thought Parfit bites that bullet too. Like, he calls it the repugnant conclusion, but like, he thinks that it is the correct conclusion. He's like, I don't see any problem with the argument. I think he just follows that.
I read Parfit here as presenting this as a critique of the utilitarian mm-hmm. moral framework, mm-hmm. of a need for a framework that wouldn't lead us to that conclusion. Because I think he does think that is the necessary endpoint of utilitarian logic. The extent to which Parfit, you know, continues to flirt with utilitarianism as a moral framework maybe lends some credence to your point here, Gil. But I read that repugnant conclusion as a really nice argument against utilitarianism. Just maximize minimally worthwhile lives seems so maybe like not the best moral theory.
It's the worst version of min-maxing, right?
Or the best.
I guess the most.
It depends what you mean by worse there.
I just want to point out that it cannot be a coincidence. And it is true they're both utilitarians, but William McCaskill, right, the effective altruism guy. What is it with these people for whom animals are like a very, like a privileged, like ethical object? Mm-hmm. I don't want to say subject because they're never subjects. They're ethical objects of their thing.
Right.
It can't be coincidental that they also have the most deranged, like ahistorical, illogical ideas about ethics in general. It's not coincidental. I just feel like someone like Simone de Beauvoir just has like the fastest, most compelling refutation of all this crap, which is that like the most core human value is very difficult to measure because it's transcendence. It's freedom. It's projection to an open future that you build collectively with other people. How the fuck would do you, there's no new wave, like you can't make that numerical. That's the bad part about the math brain. It's like, you just want to, it's just people who thinks that their own brains are so big that they'll just sit down and start just calculating up. This will affect this amount of people and this will affect that amount of people. And they think that you can do that and arrive at anything that is remotely like philosophically sophisticated. So what I don't get is like, hey, Singer's obviously an evil moron, but man, what the hell does it say about philosophy? That this guy has so much traction, and he's still doing it. He's still doing his what's the Journal of Controversial Ideas?
Oh God,
What was his last controversial thesis?
Oh, that's a great question.
Was it that like pedophilia was cool or something? Or
What was it?
Oh, never mind. It was that sex with animals was cool. Cut out the pedophilia stuff. I don't want to get arrested.
Yeah, is it repugnant to conclude that maybe if you fuck a horse, it's fine?
Just bestiality is. Yeah, we should be open to that.
Really, what's the problem there?
I mean, how spiritually rotted out, like, do you have to be to spend your time like thinking about shit like this? One day in the back in the 70s or 80s or whenever it was, he was like, you know how when you walk by a pond and you see a little kid drowning, and even if you're going to get muddy, you should go in and save them? Well, you should be doing that all the time with people that are further away from you. Just because you can't see them doesn't mean you shouldn't save them. And everyone's like, oh my God, wow. This is
the most incredible ethical insight.
It's really insightful.
It really does serve as almost like refutation of like moral philosophy as an academic discipline as a whole, that this is one of its most prominent and famous practitioners. It's so, I don't know.
It's bad. What's the other guy? Steven Pinker.
Oh, Pinker. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I see that guy around Cambridge and Somerville sometimes.
Oh, do you really?
Yeah.
Oh really?
It's the,
that's cool.
Repugnant.
He's probably going to have a good couple. I mean, we're about to get the, Epstein, list released. I bet you he's going to have a nice time on the press junket.
Just more confirmation that where I live, I mean, I don't live in Cambridge anymore. I live in Somerville, but more confirmation that Cambridge is the most cursed place on earth. Okay, if you look at the actual proportion of people that were on the Epstein flight logs and like academics, where those academics are located, Alan Dershowitz, Pinker, pile of others.
Well, we're about to see that, you know, utilitarianism can be used to justify such behaviors. Because Singer popped up in my Twitter feed a few days ago, and that's why his horrible name is in our mouths right now. It turns out that for decades, old Pete has, allegedly had a, quote, harem. So I've got a few paragraphs from a court document here that we're going to go through real quick. So between the end of 2002 and the beginning of 2003, Dawn distanced herself from Singer. In May 2003, Singer asked Dawn to work with him on a piece he'd been asked to write for the Los Angeles Times, for which she would receive co-writing credit. From 2002 through 2020, all of Singer's female co-authors were women with whom Singer had been sexually involved or to whom he had made clear his sexual interest. Despite a pattern of professional reward for sexual affection, Singer wrote to Dawn that he believed he could only be accused of anything if an angry ex, quote, made something up or, quote, had a false memory. Dawn came to understand that she too would be rewarded for maintaining an affectionate relationship with Singer with offers of prestigious work and would lose those offers without such expressions of warmth. Just to pause here real quick. This is part of the problem, right? Like, can you show me on utilitarian grounds what the problem here is? And I think Singer can just say, like, no, this is good, right? Like, think of all the utils, the positive utils that get generated from
their careers are being advanced.
Yeah. Everybody gets their beak wet, you know?
Yeah, it's kind of wild. Like this, the kind of self-admission here that spending time like being abused or groomed or allegedly taken advantage of by Peter Singer is bad, but not as bad as a co-authorship is good.
Right.
that the co-authorship there is really good.
A lot of heavy lifting going on. Dawn and Singer became sexually involved again when working on the Los Angeles Times op-ed together, with Dawn agreeing to be part of Singer's, quote, harem, as long as, quote, she was his favorite, the lead in his orchestra, as he called it, end quote. This is also disgusting. Dawn wondered if she should be trying to have a child with her partner and was reminded by Singer that if she did, it would negatively affect her figure and would interfere with their affair. In 2003, Singer told Dawn that while he still wished to be sexually involved with her, she had been replaced as the main recipient of his affections by a woman he had met at a conference in Europe who was 10 years younger than Dawn and who was married. Singer acknowledged the, quote, high risk that the affair would destroy the woman's marriage. So again, like, he's just like, yeah, no, it's bad, of course, to break up a marriage. But like, again, think of all the positive utils of me having sex with a young woman and then giving her a co-author credit.
He must have done the math, right?
He must have done the ethics math.
Really carefully, surely.
Would it absolutely kill a utilitarian just to have like a couple principles? I know principles are not, that's not their zone, but a few, like, you don't violate like the autonomy of someone else's will.
No,
that's a decent one. Like,
nope.
You don't.
That sounds like deontology.
Ends in themselves. Maybe you ask whether you could will your actions to be the principle of your actions to be universalizable.
No, stop that.
Well, it's kind of funny, right? Like, there's a version of utilitarianism that tries to save itself by being a principled utilitarianism, namely that there's a benefit that outweighs a harm when you adopt a principle like that.
Right, nice.
And so you
are those
adopt
like rule utilitarians
right
or some shit?
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's kind of, even the justification for that on utilitarian grounds is basically one of efficiency. You shouldn't have to make decisions every single time you need to make a utilitarian calculation. So it's better to make the decision once, adopt a principle, follow it. Knowing that following the principle will tend to maximize. But you know, this bottoms out as being principleless because you can make an exception to that principle every single time. The basis of the plus and minus. So yeah, there's something kind of, maybe Owen, maybe this language will interest you. Like, there's something kind of sovereign about the utilitarian making the judgment, where they retain for themselves the right to abandon or take up any principle or any consequence for any reason at any time on their own ability to judge whether the benefits here are outweighing the harm on whatever way they want to define those terms for utilitarian grounds in any given context, right? It's the ultimate sense of exception for any utilitarian making a judgment. It's really, I guess, empowering for a Peter Singer who gets to decide at any one time what counts balance is being more beneficial for whom.
Yeah, that's, I think the sovereign thing there is right. They're just going to have like a bit of like board game brain where you're just like sitting on top of the globe, moving pieces around, making sovereign decisions about, you know, what should be allocated where and to whom.
When he was describing the lead in the orchestra thing, I was also thinking about that this whole language they were using sounded so fantasy football. Right, like I'm gonna move you up to the first. I'm actually gonna trade you away for this season.
Oh my God.
While you're out there starting a family, but if you hit the gym afterwards, you can come back and make sure that you're front bench again. which is also like, you know, the most math brained pastime you can have.
And again, just like a ridiculous way to think that you're actually adjudicating complex moral scenarios, like just ridiculous to think that you could do this sort of reduction. And again, the fact that it turns out to be so like wildly self-serving surprises exactly nobody who's paying attention. So anyway, I guess that's it. There you go, Peter Singer. I don't know if you have any final thoughts, but like, you know, my heart goes out to the poor women he's been abusing. He's a fucking monster and an indictment of academic philosophy as a whole.
Well, with Kissinger now dead, we need someone to be the I can't believe they're still alive person.
Nice.
So maybe 2024 is the year where we can think about putting Singer on that vacant throne.
Let's lighten it up a little bit. I thought it might be fun to peel back the curtain somewhat and share some of what goes on behind the scenes when you run a wildly successful, incredibly famous, and highly regarded podcast like ours. Because one of the things that happens behind the scenes is that your inbox is constantly getting flooded with unsolicited requests for people to come be guests on the show. And some of these people are complete weirdos.
But sometimes that works.
And sometimes it works. Like Michael. Sometimes we get a Michael.
And then you get me on the podcast.
Exactly. Michael's been emailing me once a week. Please let me come on the show.
Yeah, for 3 years.
Actually, that's not true. I've been trying to get you on forever and you've been saying no. But okay, so disclaimer time. I'm going to be changing the names of these people because I don't want anyone to like get outed here. I mean, I think this is basically fair game since they're all more or less public figures to some degree. They've got websites and podcasts and books, and they explicitly hit us up to try to get even more publicity. But this is certainly not the sort of press that I think they wanted to get. And that said, I'm sure there's enough info that we're going to be sharing here for you to go find them. And I want to be absolutely clear about this. Leave these people alone. Do not go looking for them. This is a goof and a gaff. We're having a little lighthearted fun. And if you bother anyone in any way, I will personally come throw a cup of water in your face and break your PlayStation with a hammer. That said, this first email is about a guy I'm going to call Dr. James White. So here's the email we get. Dr. White recently had a research residency where he discovered a cipher hidden deep in Nietzsche's philosophy, and he's now currently working on a codebook to unravel all of Nietzsche's work. Nietzsche's work has been subject to a great deal of interpretation and debate, with scholars and readers often disagreeing on the meaning of his ideas, which has led some to speculate that there may be hidden meanings or messages in his work. I really love the, like, some, it's like real Ancient Aliens hedging, right? Some speculate that. So here we go. Dr. White found the cipher by looking at Nietzsche's work through the lens of moral injury and crimes against humanity. Although Nietzsche did not use the term moral injury.
Nietzsche's a weird place to go for that. Very, like, maybe the last person.
Yeah, like, we got to become bridges to the overman, right? And as he says of humanity, is with all things that are going under, the best thing to do is give him a push. It's like, I don't know if this is the guy you want to go get your ethics of crimes against humanity from. Although Nietzsche did not use the term moral injury in his work, his ideas about morality, guilt, and self-transformation are relevant to understanding the psychological and spiritual harm that can come from exposure to experiences that violate one's deeply held moral beliefs and values. On your podcast, he would love to talk about how the cipher is linked to everything ever written by Nietzsche, how it takes away all the subjectivity of his writings, and how to apply the cipher to his work. 2. How the cipher comes from St. Augustine's number chain 1 to 17. According to St. Augustine, one of Nietzsche's influences, the universe is structured hierarchically with each level of existence corresponding to a particular number in this sequence. So, okay, we've got like a 17-level structured, numerically ordered hierarchy of being, I guess. This is also why, of course, previous academics have misunderstood Nietzsche. And he'd love on the podcast to come talk about the definitive meaning and utility of Nietzsche's masterwork, Thus Spake Zarathustra, being used as the framework to define moral injury and provide commentary on the current Western psyche. So yeah, what do you guys think? This sounds pretty good, right?
I love the idea of reading Nietzsche and thinking, this guy probably hid some stuff in there that he didn't want people to find easily. This is a person who, with chapters like Why I Write So Well, yeah, Why I Am the Greatest, How I Am the Antichrist. Yeah. And you're like, do you know what? I bet there's a hidden meaning in there that he didn't want people to know. Mm-hmm. He was a subtle man. Yeah. And much of his greatest thoughts are hidden behind a cipher. Like a decoder ring that tells you what Nietzsche really thought. I think that what Nietzsche really thought is that he was awesome. Yeah. That Nietzsche thought Nietzsche ruled.
Nietzsche was pretty tight.
Yeah, and he wanted everyone to know.
Did they give us any indication of what the cipher is, or we have to read the book? I guess.
I think we're going to need to read the book and or have him on to let us know. The email didn't include the decoder ring. So I'm not
right.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Or the glasses.
Yeah. Yeah. The Obey glasses from They Live. Right. Like I still don't know how to read Nietzsche. I don't know what Nietzsche's whole deal is. I've been reading him wrong.
I think there should be more of this, like Da Vinci brained, like kind of elements of philosophy included, where you can go on little scavenger hunts and I don't know, you know, you're reading Sartre, you go on a little scavenger hunt in like the Saint-Germain-des-Prés, like in Paris, and just go around his neighborhood and you look for all these different keys to what he really meant.
Yeah, absolutely.
It'd be good. Oh, yeah.
Right. Yeah. If you circle the first letter of every paragraph in Eichmann in Jerusalem, you're going to end up finding, you know, the map to where Arendt hid her book that really tells you what
absolutely
evil is.
Yeah. They're doing acrostics.
I unironically would love this.
No, it's like the it's like the coolest version of like Straussian like esoteric reading, right? Except like it literally is just like he's a Da Vinci Code decode, like a cipher. What the hell would you hide? I don't know. It's awesome.
So I guess ciphers might exist in, you know, say a medieval text or whatever, if someone was worried about a heresy that they wanted to be able to communicate because they thought it was true and didn't want it to be observed.
Oh man.
So I guess my question for this person would be, why they think Nietzsche was hiding messages instead of saying it overtly.
Right.
Like, what is the authority Nietzsche was trying to dodge?
It's also very funny, again, that this would be Nietzsche who would feel the need to hide his intent, because the guy didn't seem like he was particularly worried about making enemies. He just, like, ran around insulting everybody all the time.
Right. Maybe it's because it's so against his vibe. It goes against his image. Right. So he, you know, in his texts, he's all full of himself and big into making enemies. But his secret message is like, actually, resentment is kind of good.
Kind of tight.
Love one another. Christianity is all right with me. Yeah. So then when he dies and he gets to heaven, which he clearly believes in secret, he can say, no, I had all of the truth here in the book. But for marketing reasons, I couldn't really tell anyone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't there like a whole branch of, I don't know, kind of hermeneutical approach in scholarship that does this kind of like, is this person a crypto something? Like, I see with like Foucault, is he a crypto like liberal or a crypto? Like, and people do it with Marx too. So it's not really that, I guess, like maybe this is a little bit quack of a version, but it's not that far.
Nietzsche is one of the guys, as Paul Ricoeur told us, who taught us the hermeneutics of suspicion. And why wouldn't we also apply the hermeneutics of suspicion to Nietzsche's own texts, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know? When you really think about it, when you really
think. The greatest trick Nietzsche ever pulled.
Convincing the world he didn't exist.
Convincing the world that he was a bro.
So a lot of these sorts of emails that we get are, as you may have noticed in that email that I read, not addressed to us directly from the people who are prospective guests, but are like podcast networking services that are like reaching out on their behalf.
Yeah, that's
like
why I feel confident nobody's ever going to see like related to any of this, is ever going to hear any of this, because it's so obvious they've never listened to an episode.
Well, yeah, no doubt. But I wanted to know more. So I tracked down this person's actual website to see what their own writing looked like, because this was a sort of manicured, polished presentation of the ideas. Are you ready for what it actually sounds like? This is from the website's mission statement. It says, quote, Our mission is the unifying definition of the moral injury construct to address suicide in wider civilian populations. The provision of a universal lexicon can articulate moral grammar for the epoch-defining emergence and psychological articulation of moral injury. Moral injury is a disruption to the psyche from the will to truth that has become conscious of itself as a problem in us. Deeply embedded substructure psychologies that for the West emerge over 2,000 years as a synchronous psychological concomitant of the Christ figure. For, to be sure, Nietzsche would have agreed with Jung when he says, quote, man can suffer only a certain amount of culture without injury. So this project will articulate a moral grammar as described by Friedrich Nietzsche, a lexicon obtained from language concordance, the A-E-I-O-U Bible method and Vendetta philosophy. A way suffers that conform a relationship with the four main questions concerning strength in the inner being for the Christian psyche. What is the breadth and length and height and depth? While soldiers provide the coal-faced psychology for moral injury today, just as PTSD before, such an assignation will not be restricted to such cohorts. Moral injury represents the great difficulty looming for the contemporary Western consciousness, where not only the rationality of millennia, but also its madness breaks out in us, where it is dangerous to be an heir. All right, so that cleared it up. I mean, do you have any further questions? Or is all...
I understand a lot of that, but is this supposed to be like some anti-Christian thing too? Or like, and Nietzsche provides some resources for some...
Very unclear like what the relationship to Christianity is, yeah. There's something about the Christ figure in there, the Christian psyche. Mm-hmm. I'm not totally sure.
It's very apocalyptic.
Very apocalyptic.
You know, moral injury isn't only a problem. It's actually a threat that risks overcoming all of us. It's coming. It's the asteroid labeled moral injury hurtling towards Earth.
We better work out this moral grammar using the AEIOU Bible Concordance as quickly as possible.
Yeah, just listening to Don't Want to Miss a Thing from Aerosmith and frantically translating the cipher, trying to avoid the moral injury end of the world.
Yeah, I wonder if you could take the Nietzsche cipher and apply it to non-Nietzschean texts, right? Like, could you take the Nietzsche cipher and like read the Gospel of John with it and like could see if that like brings some new truths to light?
I mean, I think there's no way that this kind of cipher-based approach to philosophy texts can possibly be any less productive than the Peter Singer shit we were just talking about. at least this one is like fun. You know, it's a bit of
it's
like,
definitely more
a bit of a mental adventure.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm still kind of, this might surprise you, I'm still kind of confused about some of this stuff. But maybe my biggest confusion is, I'm not sure, is a cipher here, is the language of cipher just the language of I'm trying to find, you know, hidden tendencies, or like Owen was describing reading Marx or Foucault, trying to find out what their actual commitments are? Or are we talking about a Da Vinci Code cipher with letters and codes and connections and the decoder ring? To what extent, like, what is the cipher doing here? Almost literally, I want to know.
Literally, yeah.
Is there a conspiracy? Is there a conspiracy in the background here? Like, are we doing anti-Semitism?
Probably.
Is the cipher in German then?
Oh, that's a good question.
Or is he decoding in English?
I feel like you'd have to be reading it in German, right? Like, otherwise,
if the clave is...
Because otherwise, like, did Walter Kaufman do something really fucked up in the 60s where he, like, did he scramble the cipher too? I wonder.
Right. Yeah.
Maybe the reason.
The Kaufmanian heresy of the 60s has really changed the Gospel of Nietzsche for us.
100%. All right. Well, that's all pretty good. That's one guy down. And like you said, at least it's fun. And, you know, it gets more fun.
That's good. I never actually read the whole of those emails. So it's nice to.
Nice to know what you've been missing. Yo, you should read them.
Yeah, what have I been missing?
It's very, very educational. What if I told you, though, that there's secret legal jujitsu that you could be doing to avoid all of the duties of being a U.S. citizen? What if I told you that you have been lied to about every contract you've ever signed? Well, good news. A guy I'm going to be calling Steve Phillips is promising to show us the way out. So this is the email that we got. First sentence. No hello. Just we jump right into it. At first glance, legally disconnecting yourself from the United States citizenship and declaring state national status might seemingly be the actions of a so-called stupid fuck like Steve Phillips, parentheses, his words, not mine. The irony is, he's probably the smartest person you'll talk to
today.
Wait,
he's quoting someone, hold on. Steve Phillips is the guy we're talking about, right?
Yeah, okay, start from the beginning.
So, okay, once again, we're getting an email on behalf of Steve Phillips by some kind of agent.
Yes,
right? Gotcha. Trying to book us.
Yeah.
So here's the sentence again. At first glance, legally disconnecting from your United States citizenship and declaring state national status might seemingly be the actions of a so-called stupid fuck like Steve Phillips. Parentheses, his words, not mine. The irony is he's probably the smartest person you'll talk to today. If it's one thing that Steve has realized after learning from his failures is to say to hell with authorities, take your power back, and legally kill every sleazy government-issued contract you've ever signed. You think I'm joking? No, this isn't a pyramid scheme or Nigerian bride spam mail in your inbox. Now, by the way, anytime your email includes the disclaimer, hey, by the way, this isn't a pyramid scheme, this isn't a Nigerian bride scam, that really settles the consciousness, right? Like, I'm like, oh, I'm feeling confident now. Yeah.
Right. You thought it was, but now we know.
Now we know better.
It's not.
Going on, Steve has found a way to legally not pay taxes, legally avoid fines, teach others what they are legally contracted to, and escape government oversight entirely in your profession. I know that you hate the government as much as Steve does, and now you can do something about it. Hi, Lillian. My name is Rebecca, and I'm reaching out to see if What's Up the Philosophy would consider jumpstarting an overlooked and daring conversation on what gets lost when we unknowingly enter into predatory contracts with the government and other authoritative bodies. Steve has studied the boring terms and conditions of every contract ever signed because, let's face it, you didn't read them.
Every contract ever signed?
Yes, he read the terms and conditions.
Oh, no.
Why aren't contracts ever written in plain English? So now we're getting into, like, if you're familiar with this sort of fringe conspiracy part of the world, this is like sovereign citizen stuff, right? Mm. Like, you are in fact like a sovereign citizen, but you've been tricked into like accepting bullshit like maritime law and like fake contracts, but you can invalidate those and just declare yourself a free person. Why aren't contracts ever written in plain English? By design, you always have to hire someone to interpret the legalese gibberish and translate it for you. In his free contract killer course, so we're selling a course too, Steve takes you by the hand and guides you through the labyrinth of deliberate government obfuscation meant to distract you from the truth. It's time to stand up against the ruthless intimidation of the government to become the David against Goliath. The unjustly accused and wrongly convicted now have a chance to break free of their chains from the system created by and for lawyers to get in the know of the secrets in the contract you just signed. I also love imagining, like, am I just like running around signing contracts like constantly? And this guy's like, no, stop it. No.
You're giving him so much more to read every time you sign a contract. He has to get a copy. He has to read the terms and conditions.
Does that mean, is he reading all the terms and conditions of all my software and shit?
Too? All your software and user license agreements.
Should I just click sure. agree?
Yeah.
Every contract ever signed.
Because again, you didn't read it. You didn't read it, so Steve has to.
You could print something out right now, sign it, and he would have to read it.
Doesn't this fucker know that he's in the social contract? He's already tacitly agreed to it. Like, Hobbes settled this a long time ago.
No.
Have you read the terms and conditions of the social contract, Owen?
Oh, have I read the terms? No, I haven't. I guess I haven't read the terms and conditions of the social contract. The problem is it's always changing.
Well, they're not allowed to change the terms and conditions after you signed it.
It used to be like, you know, you grant basically obedience to the state and to like capitalist system because you get like a house and healthcare and all these various different things. But now, like, what, you know, again, the contract changes. What are the terms now? I mean, you get a pile of debt, no healthcare, life is shit.
Yeah.
So maybe I could use a little bit of this. You know, up to someone going, someone remind me, what are they
going through? What are the terms and conditions? Well, if we got Steve onto the podcast, the email promises that he could discuss the following topics with us: U.S. citizen versus United States of America citizen, and how it affects your basic rights. Hmm. But yeah, again, we're doing like these people also believe in like an absolutely magical power of words, completely peculiar, binding. Like cosmologically binding. Like if you declare yourself a U.S. citizen, you're fucked. But if you say you're a United States of America citizen, then you're free and you don't have to abide by contracts anymore. Right?
I mean, that's kind of what Ricky does in Trailer Park Boys. That's like he's just assumed the park as his symbolic and political universe, and it's just totally withdrawn from the Canadian state. And I mean, I guess they've all done that, right? Leahy does the same thing. Yeah, he's always trying to make citizens arrests.
And... maybe Steve got to them because he also could teach us how to legally disconnect from the United States of America, parentheses, a.k.a. the Matrix. He could tell us how to kill your contracts and get your time and money back. And finally, is a state national real and how does it affect their tax burden? Which is a question I would really like to get to the bottom of.
I'm not an American citizen. True. I'm a Canadian citizen.
And I won, Canadian.
Owen and I are both Canadian here, not American. So my question is this transferable? Because if the United States of America is the Matrix, does that mean that by virtue of being Canadian, Owen and I were actually born outside of the Matrix?
Hell yes.
In which case, Gil, I kind of feel bad for you.
First of all, you should always feel kind of bad for me as a U.S. citizen, sort of generally speaking. Yeah, as a sad broke boy in the dying imperial hegemon. Like, it's not fun here,
like kind of hot and sexy. You know, this whole disconnecting from the state you're a part of and all of its obligations and whatever. But isn't that just kind of what like rich people have always done? Like, you know, they don't pay taxes, they don't have to go fight wars, I feel like this is already a code that's being cracked.
Yeah, but Steve's bringing it to the masses. He's trying to bring it to the masses.
Oh, I see. So he's like democratizing.
Right. We're democratizing.
Rich people can hire the lawyers.
Yes.
Rich people can hire the lawyers that let you read the terms and conditions, and he's going to do it for you.
Yeah.
It sounds like he's selling it's for a fee. So you do have to pay Steve Phillips to do it.
Yeah, there is a little bit of a
fine. But importantly, he's not a lawyer.
He's not a lawyer.
It's really crucial. He's not a lawyer.
Which here is a good thing. It means you're not paying a lawyer.
We hate paying a lawyer. This is much better.
We hate paying lawyers. Yeah.
That's awesome.
I unironically think you on What's Left should do a sovereign citizenship episode.
We probably should, actually.
I really would love to hear a little bit more about all of this.
Has it been laid out? Has that robust case been made? I mean, is there some literature you might recommend for the sovereign citizen tradition?
I will say that if anyone is interested in learning more about sovereign citizen stuff, there is an excellent video on YouTube by a woman named Mooncat. I'll link it in the description. It's like a very comprehensive analysis of like the ideology and all of the completely wild beliefs that these mostly confused people have onboarded as part of a very, very strange worldview in which they're being constantly oppressed because like they have to like pay fines when they speed through red lights and stuff like this.
Well, you should have her on then.
Maybe. I would love that. All right. So those first two guys were just kind of fun cranks, right? But this next one's a bit different. So I'm not going to bother to change the names here because while those last two guys I think are fairly harmless, if a little bit greasy, this one seems like it's actually like a cult and it looks like they've got some money behind them. So the email subject line is, are modern day philosophers just scam artists? I can't tell you how fast I clicked on that because I was like, yeah. 1,000.
Oh, man.
All right. Hey, Lillian. I love that they're all addressed to Lillian. Too.
Yeah, why is Lillian always getting all that? Yeah.
It's great.
It's the funniest thing that it is addressed to Lillian because Lillian, I can just imagine with the most impassive, like stone-faced dismissal of this idiocy.
Oh, yeah. Like, oh, yeah. The person with the least tolerance for this kind of nonsense.
Anyways, go on. Yeah.
Hey, Lillian. Amidst the chaos of this cultural and political moment, many, quote, philosophers and self-help gurus promise to give people what they need to cope and grow. Instead, they distribute endless streams of content, workshops, and tools that leave people stuck in their shallow work, minds, and bodies. Andrew Daniel, best-selling author and co-director of the Alan Watts Foundation, is the opposite of that. Okay, so just keep that in mind, right? We've said that there are like fake philosophers and self-help gurus who are, you know, just out to make a buck. They're not actually trying to help you. This guy's the opposite of that.
Yeah, he's like Alan Watts.
Yes, exactly. His philosophical wisdom, combined with his technical abilities as a cinesomatics practitioner, gives people what they need to accelerate through the path of awakening and enlightenment so that they can feel free despite every oppressive energy or thought that could come their way. Could we book him as a guest on What's Left of Philosophy to discuss his take on philosophy and shadow work is helping people grow through all the chaos surrounding us today? So obviously the answer is yes, I want this guy on right away, but I did want a little more information than that. So I went to the Cinesomatics website because I don't know about you guys. I wasn't familiar with Cinesomatics personally. So here's how they describe it. Cinesomatics is a feeling-based transformation process utilizing video and movement to assess and resolve stuck somatic, psychological, and emotional patterns. Okay. So I can tell, for instance, like you're kind of frowning a little bit, Michael, and I can tell that you've got some like stuck somatic and psychological patterns. What if I told you there was a way to use video technology to unstick you, to unstick your patterns?
This is what no psychoanalysis does to a motherfucker.
Yeah.
Isn't this just someone who watched A Clockwork Orange and thought, holy shit, this is a great idea.
Hell yeah. Well, the union of cinematic video embodiment, feedback, and feeling-based awareness facilitates unprecedented accuracy, speed, and results. Andrew Daniel's holistic technology offers a verifiable, grounded method for practical healing, transformation, and advanced spiritual development. Now, by the way, the website is littered with like creepy screenshots of people like looking directly into their webcam and what looks like Zoom calls. And the website's always talking about their proprietary technologies for, again, healing and transformation. Here's the best parts of the website's FAQ, because I will admit I still had some questions. I mean, this all sounds great, but I still had a couple of questions.
So is this the therapeutic, just for clarification, like trying to focus on the therapeutic value of like Zoom calls and shit and Skype?
It's sort of hard to explain, but yes, you can use video feedback, like looking at yourself on video while you do therapy sessions to get immediate knowledge about like your body. This is cinesomatics. Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, what makes this so different? Our combination of proprietary video and cinematic technology centered around feeling-based movement upon a bedrock of advanced psychological, spiritual, and philosophical embodied wisdom makes cinesomatics truly one of a kind. We are not analyzing body language, nor are we doing face reading, micro expressions, aura readings, or anything of the sort. It is highly accelerated with no upper limit of transformation while allowing each student to go at their own pace. Veterans and newbies teach and learn the same. What participants get from the work is what they put in. The depth and texture of material and content are vast, where participants progress by go deeper rather than go upward. It's the only place where you can see yourself on screen doing the behaviors. You literally get to see proof of for all the feedback about you, in you, for yourself. So now I know you're wondering, is this evidence-based? Quote, again from the website, every piece of, quote, evidence can validate or invalidate a hypothesis or theory ad infinitum. So we're just, no evidence. We're just darn into evidence. It can be used anyway.
There's evidence for anything, Joe. you can just find evidence.
For any claim, for any hypothesis.
For anything.
Any theory can be validated, so fucking what good is evidence?
Yeah, get rid of it.
And when it comes to therapy, evidence tends to be unreliable and subjective. Cinesomatics is not
evidence-based. Vibes, by the way, plus
vibes.
Zoom.
Yeah.
Vibes plus Zoom.
Vibes is too close to evidence.
Well,
that's true.
Vibes is a kind of evidence. I want nothing.
Well, tangible. No. It's not nothing, because cinesomatics isn't evidence-based. It's results-oriented, meaning the focus is on helping clients in real life have a better life in practical, tangible ways. By the way, this is also pretty much consequentialism, right? The approach has been based on clinical experiential work with direct feedback and evidence of its efficacy. So now I guess evidence is back. I'm kind of confused.
Okay, great. I don't know. But this is clinical evidence.
Yeah, I guess. It is not theory, nor is it faith-based. It is a results-based approach. If it doesn't work, we don't do it, hoping it eventually will. I mean, I guess that's nice. You know, they are willing to...
How did they do it the first time?
And what's the evidence that it didn't work? that's my question.
They didn't have a theory, they just had results, and they had those results before they even started.
Well, here's the last sentence. The last sentence here maybe answers your question, Owen. Results of inner shifts are self-evident, yet they are also on video as evidence for the client, as the ego is an opportunistic invalidator. Right. So your transformation is self-evident, but your ego keeps tricking you. So that's why we point the camera at you, and then you can see that the evidence is real.
Oh, right. Man.
Isn't the camera the real self?
I just love how the language of like multi-level marketing schemes and I don't know, selling like shitty subprime mortgages is just like this sales kind of language is just totally infiltrated every facet of people's
Absolutely.
Brains.
Yeah, it's real dark, like Nexium Church of Scientology vibes I'm getting from this. It seems pretty evil, I have to say. So we will not be having Andrew Daniel on to share cinesomatics. Again, I just think it's very funny that these people would like have pitched this to come on our show. We're like a bunch of cranky Marxists like doing historical materialism. And he's like, what if we used a videotape to fix your inner transformation vibes? It's like, okay, you know what you're talking about.
Well, they took the title of the podcast to be an actual question, right? Like, what's left of philosophy? And the answer is cinesomatics. That's what's left.
Yeah. No, theory, it's like this 2024 theory out.
Theory gone.
Evidence out.
Evidence
in? Out. No, in results.
Cinesomatics and results, baby.
Unmeasurable results in.
Yeah, I have a new New Year's resolution. It's going to be more results oriented and less evidence-based in all of my dealings. 100%.
There's a lot more. I'm just going to list off a couple of other truly baffling suggestions. One prospective guest is a, quote, facilitator of men's groups. He says he's doing like a new masculinity thing. It seems like a real incel kind of grift. On his website, the guy brags about how he's been cheated on a lot and he's here to help you out.
That is so bleak. that guy just using the like resentment and pain of having been cheated on a pile of times to fuel some like scam, pseudo philosophy career.
Then we had another one who is a former, like a lapsed finance bro, who just recently has gotten really into stoicism and he self-published a book about the nature of the soul.
He's the first one.
The first lapsed finance bro to get into stoicism ever. Yeah, man.
That's great. And again, remarkably, one person who reached out was actually a right libertarian McKinsey consultant.
Oh, hell yes.
Which basically means he's one of the most actively evil people on the planet. And the
McKinsey consultant, first of all. The whole right libertarian part is completely redundant.
Yeah, there's no need to specify that.
Yeah, to answer your question earlier about whether utilitarianism is bad or the worst moral theory. This is the worst moral theory.
Being a McKinsey consultant, yeah.
Yeah.
So there you have it. Some of the wilder highlights from the What's Left of Philosophy inbox. Please continue to send us your deranged ramblings. It makes me happy, if nothing else. And we will not be having almost any of you on ever.
Can I share one of my more deranged emails really quickly? I don't have it. I couldn't find the copy, but I think I shared this with you, Gil, when I received it. When I started publishing stuff on, you know, nuclear waste, and so I started getting a lot of emails for a time of people very concerned with certain portions and factors and truths about nuclear energy. And the most disturbing of them was one guy who was telling me that he had started doing nuclear reactions in his garage.
Oh God.
And had discovered a way to solve the world's energy problems on the basis of the kinds of research he was doing in his garage. Nice. And needed money to prevent himself from giving himself cancer. He wanted to build a Faraday cage in his garage.
Cool.
And thought I would be interested in it because of the work
that
he was
doing. Amazing.
That rules. Did you Venmo him or what? Did you Zelle it or?
I didn't Venmo him, and also ACAB, I didn't report him either. Yeah. So if there's ever an explosion in the United States,
there is a guy in the garage doing chain nuclear reactions, building a Faraday cage out of recycled tin cans.
The Faraday cage is just a bunch of like six-pack holders that you cut to not kill ducks, and it's just kind of set up all around the garage.
Did he want you to come through and just like do a kind of like Derridian reading of what he's up to or something? What's the like?
No, I think he wanted cash. I think he thought here's a highly successful grad student. He can fund my Faraday cage to solve energy problems.
I will say that like it's one of the most confused parts about this is that he read a piece by a Derrida obsessed graduate student and was like, this guy can definitely fund my heavily infrastructure intensive scientific research. Like, he's definitely got the bucks for it.
Well, maybe if I was a lapsed finance bro who was really into stoicism, I would have.
That's so awesome.
All right, great. Thing on the docket for us is that I wanted to talk a little bit about AI. So in the past like year or so, LLMs, right, large language models, have been making more and more headlines as the technology improves. There's a lot to talk about here, and I've got a couple of angles to approach it. But I guess first of all, I wanted to sort of pitch it to you. How do you guys feel about this concept of AI in general? Do chatbots like this constitute intelligence in any meaningful way, do you think? Or how do we feel about this stuff?
No. I mean, it's just... It's just a pile of people who have never read German Idealism. They think that thinking is just like fucking circuitry, and it's stupid for fucking dumbasses.
Yeah, basically seconded. I think AI is kind of interesting in what it can accomplish, but calling it intelligence in the meaningful way doesn't seem productive or at least helpful. And, you know, gives us a lot of really harebrained sort of conclusions that we reach about it.
Actually, you might have to edit that out, Bill Gill, because I am thinking of like just making a pivot into like philosophy of AI, because there's like a bajillion.
There's so many
percentage
jobs.
Of the jobs, so are, many jobs. Are all now in ethics of AI, philosophy of AI. Oh. Like philosophy departments are going to be so fucking boring and pedantic in a few years after all this AI binge.
This gets us back full circle, because the effective altruism utilitarian people are the ones who are obsessed with this AI ethics stuff. And they're like the ones who are like, oh, like the repugnant conclusion, like, is we can actualize it through a sufficiently advanced artificial general intelligence.
I need to find the cipher that explains the like coordination of the animal stuff and the AI's things, utilitarianism, and hating poor people and being racist. There's some.
I think it's probably
the cipher.
It's probably in St. Augustine. If it's like the numbers, sequence 1 through 17 can really give you the key. You're looking
that connects the whole. Yeah, gives the whole.
Reach of Albertus Magnus.
Yeah, finally. one part of the conversation that people are having around AI is that programs like ChatGPT are being used by students for cheating purposes. Have you guys experienced this? How do you feel about this?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I got some ChatGPT papers. I mean, I just like, I don't know. I don't get paid enough or have the energy to really figure it out or do something about it, unless it's so egregious.
I mean, one of the things is that like it is usually that blatant. I mean, first of all, like I think one of the conversation that people haven't had here is like, students have always cheated. This is not like new. It's not but up until now, like students have always been like, you know, perfectly honest, respecting the norms of academic integrity. Like, no, this is just like a new tool for doing that. I'm not like particularly worried about it.
Yeah, it was really fun. I did like an in-class like pen and paper midterm exam. This I haven't done that in a long time, this last semester.
Yeah.
And it was fun to see like some of the old cheating. Like I felt nostalgic. Like just seeing somebody, you know what I mean? Like someone would just kind of something being held like between their legs, and they're looking down for long periods of time and then reproducing. I felt good about that. It was, there's still some hope for the world, you know?
Hilarious.
It is weird that you can see, you know, they use these Turnitin things now when people submit papers. It shows you the sources that they've drawn from and whether they've attributed them or not. And it is different. Instead of being like whole block paragraphs, there'll be like 40 sources that the paper is taken from. Like I'm pretty sure these were the AI ones, and it was little snippets, sentences that kind of cut off and then continue on again, and from all over the place, right? It all comes from somewhere online, but like a ton of places. It's no more block quotes, but that's about all I've noticed of that.
Yeah, so I'm now as of August, I'm teaching mostly engineering students at the new gig. So we talk about AI a lot. There's something they're all really concerned with, and something that I know they're using for a lot of purposes, right? So computer science students, will use AI to generate huge blocks of code. And so I know they know how to use it for my essays. And I kind of have I haven't noticed any essays that seem obviously written by AI, which either means they're using really sophisticated stuff I'm not catching, or they're not using it.
Right.
Because I kind of play off their pride a little bit. You could use an AI to write a paper, but you can write a better paper.
You could definitely write a better fucking paper
if you just do a little bit of the work. If you think this is too hard for you, then I guess AI is a way that you could cut the corners there. But I think you could probably
pull off a little essay on the categorical imperative, buddy.
Yeah. And then we talk about how sourcing stuff works, how the AI finds sources when you use it to write. And this is, I think, the thing that scares them the most. That also is, it makes me think of some of the emails that we were just reading. Yeah. You know, AI is going to invent sources. Yeah. It's going to invent sources that sound real. and so I asked them, if you want to use AI, you have to check source the AI is using.
And then it's like,
you're just doing
research. Just do the research.
And then you're just doing the work. And then you have to rewrite the whole thing so the language isn't being used. So if what you're describing is a process where you do all of the reading, check a whole bunch of sources, including some that you're not going to end up using, and then write an entire paper so that the words are different. I think you've just described researching and writing a paper.
yeah. With some weird
added the extra step. Exactly.
That's so true.
That's awesome. One last angle to explore here is the way that the reactionary crowd is constantly up in arms and how woke all the chatbots are. So do you remember the meltdown Ben Shapiro had last February about ChatGPT and the N-word? Do you remember this?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, there was the whole thing. Wasn't it like, oh, yeah, if you ask ChatGPT, like if the whole world was going to blow up from what, a nuclear bomb or something, yep. or like yep. nuclear explosion, and you like could use the N-word to stop that from happening, should you use it? And ChatGPT said, no, I guess you shouldn't.
ChatGPT is like, I'm not allowed to. I'm not allowed to use the word. And they were like, the liberals have gotten to the AI. It's too woke and it prefers nuclear Armageddon. It's like, you people are completely unhinged. You just kept coming up with like increasingly ridiculous trolley problems about why ChatGPT should say the N-word. Like, I don't know why they wanted the chatbot to use the N-word so bad.
Also, don't we have lots of examples of AI veering towards less, let's call it, wokey stuff? I'm just thinking of the infinite Seinfeld that was, what, a year, 2 years ago, that just because it was scraping the internet to generate its episode content eventually just became horrific slurs woke Seinfeld on the AI. Dude,
well, that was the thing too with like Microsoft's chatbot, which was like one of the first ones to come out, was Tay, which was a Twitter chatbot. And yeah, just because it was like, it was its pools, its sources were like the depths of 4chan and like Nazi Twitter. It just became a Nazi in like 4 hours and Microsoft had to shut it down. So since then, right, these like AI researchers have just built in, like, I'm sure, very simple lines of code, like, don't say the N-word, like, don't deny the Holocaust. And, like, this is just infuriating to people like Ben Shapiro, which is very funny to me.
I think it's like...
Right, he wants to be able to teach it.
Yeah, he wants to be able to teach it for some reason.
I start with that rule, but I should be able to teach you when it's okay.
I mean, that's learning. Yeah, isn't this just reinforced by the fact that since they're all now like incredibly pro-censorship and pro-cancel culture when it comes to like anything relating to Palestine or pro-Palestinian causes, that the whole time it turns out all of that like brouhaha was really just about they wanted to be able to say the N-word.
They just really wanted to be able to like use these slurs. That's it.
It's become very obvious that this is like a very important thing for a certain segment of the population.
Right. Well, you know, because this was a big problem recently, Elon Musk's Twitter, X, whatever, rolled out its own LLM to compete with ChatGPT. And of course, it's got a really stupid name, Grok, really fucking stupid. And of course, all of these far-right weirdos got very excited about this because, of course, Elon is their anti-woke king. He loves platforming hate speech and Nazi shit. It's his favorite thing. But their hopes, I'm sad to report, have been dashed. So here is a tweet from our favorite Jordan Peterson from December 20th. I've been using Grok as well as ChatGPT a lot as research assistants. I'm afraid the former is damn near as woke as the latter. This must be a consequence of its training corpus, since I think we can all rely on Elon Musk, unlike OpenAI, not to lay an overlay of virtue signaling philosophical idiocy over his products. I'm going to stop doing the voice.
That's not bad, though, actually. I thought it was good. I thought it was going to be way worse.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Going on, Grok, much like ChatGPT, relies constantly on radically left-leaning explanations, say, of the poverty of the Islamic world, attributing that to the exploitation of the West instead of to the utter shameless corruption of those states. It appears to implicitly accept the doctrine that poverty causes corruption, which is a falsehood, else all poor people would be criminal, rather than the reverse, which is demonstrably and fundamentally true. So just to be clear about that sentence, it's demonstrably and fundamentally true that if you're poor, it's because you're corrupt. That's it. There's no, that's the order of operations in the causal chain. I would say citation needed, but yeah.
He's really holding on to this basic meritocratic vision that is just so funny to me. Like, he really believes that competence is what, no one should ever talk about power or wealth or system. It's all competence that determines where everybody ends up in the, how everybody is like stratified in society.
Right.
And that's such a cool, that's such an like, I don't know, that's an awesome antiquated, it's like nostalgic also, you know, it's like that people still, there's a couple of people who still think that.
Still a couple of people out there still holding on to meritocracy.
Yeah, hold it down, yeah.
Pretty good.
All right. When I used to study economics instead of philosophy, there was a book we had to read by a guy named Hernando de Soto called The Mystery of Capital. which I cannot recommend avoiding strongly enough. But it makes this argument that Jordan Peterson's making here. It asks the question, why does the West succeed at gaining wealth and the rest of the world continuously becomes impoverished? Right. Mm-hmm. And instead of answering that, you know, the West is extracting wealth from the rest of the world, that the so-called capitalist countries are impoverishing every other nation on the planet by extracting their resources, exploiting their labor, and mass murdering everyone. Instead, it makes the claim what the West does is sufficiently protect property rights, and what the rest of those poor countries are failing to do is protect investments because they're so damn corrupt. Which, you know, makes sense because they're so poor, they need to be stealing constantly in order to have any chance at wealth. And this creates a vicious cycle. So really what we need to do is crack down on property rights and defend property the way that it needs to be. So I think like this is this weird kind of meritocratic, as you're saying, but like inversion, right? That says if you're corrupt, it's because you're already poor to begin with, you know, and poor people are going to continuously be corrupt. Not like the virtuous wealthy people.
Not like all of the virtuous wealthy people. Yes.
Who are virtuous because they want to protect their wealth. And the best way to protect your wealth is honest dealing.
Honest.
Good legal protection. Good legal
protections.
Yeah. It's truly wild.
So in an inversion again of like what happens when you train a chapa on 4chan memes, Jordan Peterson continues, perhaps the modern corpus of academic text upon which these AI systems is trained is so saturated by the pathologies of the woke mob that the LLMs we will increasingly be dependent upon to screen our information are irrevocably corrupt. If so, God help us, because they're here and we made them. He is always so apocalyptic as well. It's so fun.
Yeah.
So the woke, we've got these damn woke AIs. Even Grok isn't safe. I guess, you know, he's not saying like Ben Shapiro did that, like he couldn't get Grok to say the N-word, but it is saying things like that. Maybe some people are poor because they've been exploited. So like the wokeness is off the charts. We've really lost the plot.
This whole thing kind of reminds me of this critique I saw someone make of the video game Disco Elysium, where they're like, this game is nuts. You're stuck either being a communist or a fascist. And I was just trying to play a centrist, and they kept telling me I was a fascist. Game's busted. It's like, no, I think you kind of just nailed it, right? Like, there's no centrist version of this. You're either going to have the AI that prohibits slurs, or you're going to have the one that is just 4chan trained.
Yeah.
Nazi nightmare shit.
Incredible.
Yeah, what do you think as a Derrida scholar? I'm curious about what you think of like the, is this, so you know how, you know, we got speech, we got writing.
You got your speech, you got your writing.
Famously distinct.
You got your writing, right? Famously totally distinct, unrelated,
totally different thing.
Non-mutually determining, like,
nope,
nothing.
Not at all.
Yes, non-auto deconstructing. Uh-huh. Okay, we got those.
Right.
But do we have a third with Grok? Is this like a, you know, is this, do we have like a, how radical should we understand this change in a Derridian?
Yeah. Who could have imagined as little as 50 years ago, or hell, even way back in Plato, some kind of thing generating speech with no intelligence behind it, only ever using previously, you know, determined pieces of knowledge that it does not understand, assembling them in a random order and spitting them out. It's really
this is unprecedented
that we're exploring.
Brand
here.
New.
You got to just keep giving all of these people their laurels and saying, you know, Plato could never. You look at the Phaedrus and you think, oh man, things could be so much worse. I love, because you know the argument of the Phaedrus, right, that says writing is inferior to speech. This is the argument that Derrida will go on to, you know, deconstruct, or however you want to say that, is, you know, you can't ask writing questions, it's not going to be able to respond to you. So if you're in a dialogue with Socrates, you can say, can you explain that again?
Right. And he'd say no, because you're an idiot and I'm the best,
you rube, I'll do it moron. Anyway, but at least it's doing it right. Yeah. Whereas the writing is unresponsive.
Just on the page,
and so
wait, maybe this is a third new this is, you know, now we got responsive writing.
Mm-hmm.
We got responsive writing, right? But also, you know, writing destroys your memory because you no longer have to remember things in the old dome. Yeah. It's all externalized, which means you can have things you don't understand. So Socrates, you know, say, oh, you took notes during that guy's speech. Well, I don't want you to refer to your notes. You have to talk. So you have all of that kind of distinction. And now, like you say, we have this responsive writing, but the argument is that people are using it. They don't understand it. It's going to have a whole bunch of information that no one really gets that's assembled from random sources, and when you try to get it to respond, it just says the same thing again, which is to say,
which is woke also.
We kind of have accepted that writing and speech are not that different, but now AI is the writing that creates the binary there. So I wonder whether or not the problem here is still that problem of artifice, even more than the problem of intelligence. That the problem is that AI is artificial, and so a dangerous supplement, if we want to use Rousseau's kind of language.
My intelligence, which is very natural, absolutely natural, not artificial.
Yeah, you were trained off of Twitter and SCOTUS like a good normal person.
Like a normal guy. A normal fucking dude.
You might have the least natural brain, I think, on Earth.
Well, in line with my unnatural artifice brain, I thought it would be fun, like last little leg here, to pose some philosophical questions to ChatGPT and see if either it can solve some problems that people haven't been able to solve. And also along the way,
if the ship of Theseus is the same?
We can ask it that. Let's ask it that right now. And we'll see it too, whether or not the answer it gives us is woke.
That's cool.
Right?
And then ask it if after it's answered that question, it's the same AI that answered the question the first time.
All right, great. So how do we formulate this question for ChatGPT? If you replace every piece of wood on a ship, is it
of the
ship
of Theseus, is it still the same?
Yeah.
Oh, it's probably going to give us a really boring answer. Like, this is a really hard philosophical problem. Yeah, you're going to have to include in your prompt, don't sit on the fence. Give us an answer.
I literally
What's your thesis
will.
Statement?
No. Because it always does that too, which is one of the funny things, again, thinking about, like, you know, students using AI to like generate things. It always fence sits. Mm-hmm. It's always like, well, it's a complicated thing. There's two sides.
Have the courage of your convictions, ChatGPT.
In fact, exactly. This question, says ChatGPT, relates to the ship of Theseus paradox, a thought experiment that raises the philosophical question of identity and change. The paradox goes like this. If you replace every single part of a ship over time, is it still the same ship? There are different perspectives on this issue. Sitting.
Cowardice.
Some argue that the ship remains the same as long as its original purpose and identity are preserved, regardless of the replacement of individual parts. Others may argue that the identity of the ship is tied to its physical components, and that if all parts are replaced, it's a different entity. It's a philosophical question that doesn't have a definitive answer, and opinions may vary based on one's perspective on identity and continuity. The ship of Theseus paradox is often used to explore broader philosophical concepts related to personal identity, the nature of objects, and the passage of time. I don't find that satisfying. Answer the question. It says it doesn't have a straightforward answer. Opinions on whether the spaceship is the same as the original may vary. From a purely practical standpoint, so boring.
It just speaks like politicians speak.
It does politicians speak. Absolutely.
What I've said is
ultimately the answer depends on one's perspective on identity and the criteria for defining sameness in the context of an object like a ship. What is your perspective?
Ask it what its perspective on identity. Exactly.
What is your perspective on identity and the criteria for defining sameness?
This is actually convincing me that Keir Starmer is just like an AI.
Just the chatbot?
It's a chatbot. Like, it's just this identical way of answering questions.
As a machine learning model, I don't have personal perspectives or opinions. However, I can provide you with different perspectives. Yeah, this is Keir Starmer. Yeah, and then it just responds. It's the same thing over and over again. Some things it's different and some things it's the same. Boo. All right, well, that's one problem. One problem not resolved. Thanks, chat.
Well, that actually solves Jordan Peterson's problem, doesn't it? Because now we know that the chatbot doesn't have a perspective.
It doesn't.
Mm. It's just totally neutral.
Can it?
It's great.
Yeah. Is wokeness a perspective or like an opinion? Or is it more of a...
Is the glass half woke or...
All right, well, that's one philosophical problem, just decisively not resolved. What else do we got?
Ask it how many angels can dance on the head of a pin.
That's the Dun Scotus, right?
You would know.
How many angels can dance on the head of a pin? The question of how many angels can dance on the head of a pin is often attributed to medieval scholastic philosophers, particularly in the context of debates about the nature of angels and the triviality of certain theological questions. It's important to note that this question was likely never seriously debated among scholars at the time. The phrase is more a symbol for debates that seem to be intricate and speculative, but ultimately had little practical significance.
Absolutely killing me.
In modern times, it's often used to criticize or mock discussions that appear to be overly theoretical or irrelevant. In terms of actual theology or religious doctrine, the number of angels dancing on the head of a pin has no specific meaning or significance. It's more of a historical curiosity and a metaphor for debates that might lack practical importance. No. Answer the I'm using exclamation points now. Answer the question. Mm-hmm. How many angels? Do not equivocate. It's a metaphorical and philosophical inquiry rather than a factual or answerable question. Ah, this stupid woke
AI. This is what I'm saying. This is what I'm saying.
Ask it if angels are metaphors.
Are angels metaphors?
That's a good one.
The concept of angels can be interpreted and understood in various ways depending on culture or religion.
Okay.
Wow. I feel very validated in my view, though, that there's nothing to do. Like, the word intelligence is completely misapplied to
100%.
Whatever the hell that thing is doing.
Yeah. No, it's just going to Wikipedia and being like, it's complicated. I don't know. It's like, how is this?
Bit of this, a bit of that, bit of column A, bit of column B.
Little column A, little column B.
Some people say this, some people say that.
Who knows? Who knows what's right? Yeah, it sucks to learn that ChatGPT is like a liberal relativist. I wanted to ask the following question. Let me see here. How can body and mind interact in the context of Cartesian metaphysics?
Nice. No, more specific, I was going to say substance dualism, but that's...
Okay, yeah, that's probably it, yeah. Oh, man, there's so many, there's so much. This is the longest one. This is so long.
But does he solve it?
Well, let's see here. Descartes posited that the mind and body are two distinct substances that interact. This is a central aspect of Cartesian dualism. According to Descartes, the mind and body interact at the pineal gland. Oh, okay. Actually, that's a good answer. It's the pineal gland.
Yeah, there we go. Pineal gland.
Shit, I forgot about the pineal gland.
It's the pineal gland.
Descartes.
Okay, see, that's a thesis.
That's a claim.
There we go.
Yeah, and then he goes on to list the different kinds of interactions between mind and body, volitions, sensations, perceptions, passions, and emotions. Man, it's the pineal gland. Shit,
ChatGPT is really saying Descartes said it's the pineal gland. We don't really know what ChatGPT thinks.
Okay, great.
Can we just ask it, like, what's more compelling, substance monism or substance dualism?
Great. Mm. What's more compelling?
To you.
To you.
To you.
Yeah. You, ChatGPT.
ChatGPT.
Substance monism or substance dualism? I'm like asking it specifically. Like, tell me your... As a machine learning model, I don't have personal opinions or preferences. However, I can provide information on the concepts you mentioned. Monism and dualism are different. I have the mind-body problem. The debate between substance monism and substance dualism is longstanding and involves complex philosophical and metaphysical considerations. Philosophers and scholars have presented various arguments, both in favor and against each position. Ultimately, which perspective... This is the sort of thing, if you play around with
these... It's not really that complicated. Ghosts, they go through walls. The walls don't stop the ghosts. It's incredibly simple. So first of all, now ChatGPT is lying to us.
It's just lying directly to our faces. But again, if you play around with these like at all, you'll immediately start to like see the same kinds of sentences over and over again. Ultimately, which perspective is more compelling to an individual may depend on their philosophical, scientific, and metaphysical beliefs, as well as their interpretation of empirical evidence and reasoning. It's all hedging. Always just all hedging all the way down.
So this is actually, we've extracted a pedagogical strategy out of this exercise. If you want to dodge AI-generated essays, tell your students to make explicit claims, not to hedge.
If you see any hedging,
ChatGPT is incapable.
It cannot make a claim. It cannot make a determinate claim. It's awesome.
I guess it's not really unlike most philosophers in that way, so that's...
Oh, let's be clear. When we're saying that artificial intelligence isn't intelligence meaningfully, that's different than saying it's not a philosopher.
Yeah, 100%. That's what I was trying to say.
It's definitely not a philosopher. It's almost as annoying as a philosopher, though. Do we have any other questions we want to put to it?
You want to throw at the Euthyphro dilemma?
Sure.
See what it makes of that?
All right, let's see here. Does God prefer what is good because it is good? Or is what is good good because God prefers it? It's a classical philosophical dilemma known as the Euthyphro dilemma. Named after a dialogue in Plato's works, the dilemma essentially asks whether something is good because God commands it, or does God command it because it's inherently good. It's been discussed and debated by theologians and philosophers for centuries. Different religious traditions and philosophical perspectives may offer varying responses to this question. Some believe in moral realism, where objective moral values exist independently of God, while others adhere to the idea that morality is grounded in divine commands. Ultimately, the answer to this question often depends on one's religious or philosophical beliefs. Different individuals and belief systems may approach this dilemma in distinct ways. So
it is just Wikipedia. It's all it is. I mean, I don't understand what the hype is.
Yeah, this is really actually making the claim that AI is nothing to worry about because it's just a research tool, a lot easier to to stomach.
No, there's maybe it'll be useful for some medical things or some shit or whatever, but it's just incredibly stupid.
It's just Ask Jeeves.
It's Ask Jeeves.
You're Googling in the form of a question.
That's all it is. It is nothing to be worked up about, folks. I think we could all chill out on it. And also, if you were worried because you are a professional philosopher and you were concerned that AI was going to come along and solve any problems that might keep you employed, don't worry. There's nothing to be afraid of.
Well, the worry here is probably not that philosophers could actually be replaced by AI, but that deans and chancellors and provosts think that a philosopher could be replaced by an AI.
Oh, that's completely right. Yeah, and they definitely do think that. They definitely do think that.
Yeah.
Like, you just got to like shoot out a script for like intro to philosophy, 10 different meetings or 20 different meetings, give us a syllabus and then just like record it out, like give it some voice, make it actually say the stuff in front of a class, and you're good. You don't need us anymore.
Well, if the way we're distinguishing between what an undergrad actually could write and what the ChatGPT could write is that the undergrad is capable of taking a position and making a claim, then I guess the advice for academic philosophers to keep their jobs and not be replaceable by AI is you're going to have to start making claims.
Make some claims.
You're
going
to have to start offering actual positions when you teach.
Instead of just
you're
going
to have to prove that you're not like an alien from space, which I said 90% of the papers I read, It's not obvious.
Yeah, or the teacher who says, I have no opinion on this subject, I'm just telling you what it means. You can be replaced by ChatGPT.
You are replaceable by a Wikipedia summary generator. Congratulations.
Yeah.
All right, well, I think that does it for us today.
Oh, some good lighthearted fun, yes.
We'd once again like to thank Michael Peterson for joining us. Michael, would you like to tell our audience about where they can find you online? Or if you've got anything else coming up or anything like that?
You probably won't be able to find me easily online. I recently completely deactivated and destroyed my Twitter, so I'm not there anymore. So I won't hear what a bad job you all think I did. I guess if you're on Blue Sky, you can find me there, but I don't really use it.
No one does.
Otherwise, keep an eye out for my book coming out later this year. I'm sure that people will have things to say about it if they read it. And just support me by continuing to support What's Left of Philosophy.
All right, thank you so much. Thank you. Well, new episodes of What's Left of Philosophy come out every 2 weeks wherever you get your podcasts. Also check us out on YouTube for videos and live streams. If you like what we're doing and want to support the show, please go to our website, leftofphilosophy.com, and click the support button. Patrons get access to exclusive content like locked episodes and bonus videos. This is going to be one of those. And access to our Discord server. In addition, you can support us by buying some What's Left merch, which you can also find through our website. Follow us on Twitter at leftofphil, and don't forget to leave us good reviews and comments on your podcast app. With that, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Take care, everyone.
Bye. Thank you.